journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass dissent.
These are weapons of mass dissent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Thursday, August 20th, 2009, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar.
Silence is not an option.
Earth Days, a new history of the successes and failures of the modern environmental movement, a report from Afghanistan's presidential elections, and violence in post-coup Honduras. This is Uprising. Good morning and welcome to Uprising. Violence across Afghanistan has marked voting today, with the Taliban setting off attacks across the country earlier this week through today. Bloomberg is reporting that Taliban attacks forced as many as 11% of polling stations to close. Voter turnout was high in some parts of the north, controlled by militia commander Abdul Rashid Dostum, who just returned to the country at the invitation of incumbent President Hamid Karzai. But in the southern parts of the country, where Karzai was counting on his Pashtun supporters, voter turnout appears to have been low, due in part to the threats of violence. In recent days, the Taliban have issued warnings that they would cut off the ink-stained fingers of those who vote. Meanwhile, the Free and Fair Elections Foundation of Afghanistan has reported widespread vote fraud for the past several months, including the sale and exchange of voter cards and the manufacture of thousands of counterfeit cards. Additionally, millions of voter cards may have been issued to minors, including children as young as 12. An initial result is expected within 48 hours, as counting has just commenced, but the formal vote tally to be done by the Karzai-controlled Independent Electoral Commission will be released on September 17th. If no candidate wins at least 51% of the vote, a runoff will take place in October. Now joining us live with Human Rights Watch in Kabul is Rachel Reed. Welcome to Uprising, Rachel. Are you with us? Rachel? Well, we're trying to, we'll try to reach Rachel one more time. Rachel Reed is Human Rights Watch representative in Kabul. Also with us is Robert Baer, former CIA operator and author of several books, including The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower. Robert, welcome to Uprising.
Thanks for having me.
Well, while we're waiting to reach Rachel, it's certainly quite difficult to get through to folks in Afghanistan right now. You are one of the people featured in the latest installment of Brave New Films series Rethink Afghanistan on the issue of security. Security, of course, being a major concern during these elections. Are you surprised by the level of violence seen leading up to the election and on election day itself?
Oh, not at all. I think what we're seeing is we're in the middle of a civil war. Where the two principal ethnic groups are the Uzbeks. The three are the Uzbeks, the Pashtuns, and the Tajiks. Karzai is backed by the Tajiks, even though he's a Pashtun. And so what we're seeing are these divisions, and we're seeing the Pashtuns reacting. And don't forget, the Pashtuns are the people that we're firing Hellfire missiles to in the tribal areas of Pakistan. So in essence, we have taken sides in this war, the Tajiks against the Pashtuns. To see this violence isn't a surprise at all.
Rachel Reed, are you with us?
I'm with you, yeah.
Now, Rachel, you're in Afghanistan, and the reports that we're hearing from Afghanistan are that the Taliban did manage to, through some violence, even though some was thwarted, they did manage to close down as much as 11% of the polling places. What has Kabul been like on voting day in terms of turnout as well as violence?
Well, actually, even here in Kabul, turnout has been pretty low. I spoke to one person who estimated it was down by about 30%. Oh, sorry, it was as low as 30% here. And that's in the capital city where there's huge security. So you just imagine what the turnout must be in the south and the east of the country, where we're hearing reports of very low turnout. I have to say it's a bit of a guesstimate. It's very hard to get accurate data on any of this, but there was a lot of fear in Kabul. There had been about 5 major attacks in the days running up to the elections, and then, of course, from about 6 in the morning until 11 o'clock this morning, there were a large number of IEDs, of explosions and rocket attacks. And there was a couple of incidents of firefights, one major firefight in the east of the city. I spoke to some residents in that area who had been really excited about voting today and who were too scared to go. So I think some people were scared off. And, you know, thankfully the death toll wasn't as high as some feared, but clearly enough violence to scare a lot of people in many parts of the country away from the polling stations, although the turnout is apparently very high in the north.
That's right. And I had mentioned in my introduction that that is being attributed to the return of Abdul Rashid Dostum, the warlord who controls some provinces in the north and promised to deliver millions of votes to Karzai. Based on what you have seen in Afghanistan, what do you think the results are going to be? Not the reported results necessarily, but in terms of votes actually cast, do you think a large number of people voted for Karzai and that he might get more votes than anybody else?
I think if you look at the turnout, then it's going to be very difficult for Karzai to win on the first round, where this is a free and fair election, because turnout's been so low in the south and east, not just because turnout's been so low, actually polling stations weren't able to open in many provinces. In Ghazni, for example, half the polling stations were not open. So when that kind of thing is going on, were all things equal, it would be hard for Karzai to get 50%. If you look at the polling even before Election Day, polling again, you take with a pinch of salt, he wasn't getting the 50%. So it was interesting to see Richard Holbrook saying today, and you know they've been fairly quiet, the US, about the conduct of the elections, but he said very clearly, although it looks fairly transparent today, we have to guard against serious fraud for the counting. So what's really critical now in the next day or so is what happens with the counting.
Mm-hmm. Robert Baer, the Taliban, as I mentioned, have threatened people with cutting off their fingers if they were found to have ink on them. Those who do go to vote are supposed to have their fingers dipped in ink to show that they voted. How much of that do you think Afghans, particularly in the south, are taking seriously?
Well, I think that the Afghans are supportive. A lot of them are supportive of the Taliban, and the other ones are terrified of them. It is, you know, the politics are brutal in Afghanistan, whether Uzbek, Tajik, or Pashtun politics. And I think they're terrified. It kept them away from the polls. And as you said, this is the reason Karzai brought in Dostum, is just to get the vote count up. I mean, but, you know, Dostum is not just a warlord. He's been accused and proved of massacres, in particular Pashtuns in the north. That's why the reason he left the country. He is not well-liked in that country, except among Uzbeks.
And, Robert, on this issue, Karzai's wheeling and dealing of the past several months, the allegations of bribery, of corruption, of threats, there have been village elders who have reported that they've been told if they didn't get their entire village to vote for Karzai, that they would be threatened with violence. All of these things that Karzai seems to have sort of marshaled to try to get as much of the vote as possible. What does that say about the U.S. occupation, which is ostensibly supporting and defending the government of Afghanistan against Taliban attacks?
Well, we've turned a blind eye to corruption. I mean, the Karzai government is involved in heroin smuggling and opium growing. We've completely turned a blind eye. Many of the defense contracts there, private security contracts, the money is just being stolen, and in particular gasoline and jet fuel and the rest of it. It is a thoroughly corrupt country, and since October 2001, we've done nothing about it. We've just ignored it. And this administration has done a little better than the Bush administration.
Rachel Reed, how are people viewing the U.S. and NATO occupation in light of the election? And also, from your experience, what are people's opinions of the president, Karzai, who has long been viewed as a U.S. puppet?
Yeah, well, there are certainly many Afghans who see him in that way and who are very disappointed that he seems to be creating a new cabinet made up of all the old warlords, including bringing back some of these warlords that we thought had been pushed out of the centre of the system. You know, he's got Marshal Fahim as his vice presidential candidate, as you've been saying. Dostum is coming back into the fold. So they look with very jaded eyes at this crowd coming back into power, as is likely to happen, almost whatever happens with this election, I fear. And unfortunately, governments like the US, the UK, many of the governments here who are so active have not really done much, fall fairly silent on this issue of warlordism, which is connected to the issue of drug traffickers being and corruption in government as well. All these things overlap. It's these patronage networks. It's this criminal class of politicians, which is another very significant reason for apathy as well, I think, about these elections. For months now, we've heard rumours about which former warlord Karzai was doing a deal with, whether it was Sayaf or Dostum or Ayatollah Mosseni over this repressive Shia law that that women have been campaigning against here. And it's very disillusioning for the Afghan people who want to embrace democracy. I mean, they show it on a day like today, despite all the violence. We still see some amazing signs. There are amazing reports coming from one province in Wardak, where you saw pictures of voters going to the polls in the middle of a firefight. I mean, there's such enthusiasm for it, but they don't have much to inspire them in their political class, unfortunately.
What about the recent televised debate, the only one that Karzai participated in that featured the top four candidates? The independent political candidate, Ramzan Basha Dost, was seen as the clear winner of that, but he is the least funded. Do you think that played a role in people's decisions on how they were going to vote?
Well, I think some of those presidential debates have been influential, and actually it was significant that Karzai didn't bother to engage with them initially. Basha Dost, I think, probably all things being equal, again, would be a very popular candidate. I mean, his message is very clear. It's anti-corruption, and he's very clear about how the political class has failed Afghans here. But there are a couple of factors that come into play. One is, unfortunately, people still vote to a degree along ethnic lines. And Basha Dost is from the Hazara community. But two, as you say, probably more significantly, he hasn't engaged in vote buying, and he's run a clean campaign without much support, and it's really hard to make an impact in that way. So, I mean, it was interesting, if you look at a poll that came out last month, he was actually in the lead of the opposition candidates, just behind Dr. Abdullah, ahead of someone like Ghani, who was expected to be much better. So he's been surprisingly popular. But whether or not he gets a high turnout, a high vote on the day is another question. But certainly his message is a popular one.
I want to turn back to Robert Baer. You are featured, as I mentioned, in the latest installment of Brave New Films' Rethink Afghanistan series, this one on security. How directly related to the U.S. occupation is the level of both Taliban violence and warlordism? So Taliban violence in the south, warlordism in the north. Have you seen both sort of increase proportionally as the U.S. campaign first ramped up its airstrikes and now ramped up its ground offensive over the last couple of years?
I've seen it. I mean, you know, my prejudice, of course, I have to say, is I was on the other side in the 80s supplying arms to the Mujahideen, and this was a very easy thing to do. In terms of defeating the Soviet Union, the Red Army. So that's my bias. And what I see in Afghanistan is a very xenophobic country who does not take well to occupation, anyone's occupation. And frankly, and I'll go back to the same point, we have been so clumsy about supporting the Tajiks. This is partly the CIA's fault because it went in the Panjshir Valley in October 2001. It picked up with Fahim and moved into Kabul with the Tajiks. Even today, the U.S. military uses Tajik translators who viscerally oppose the Pashtun. And so you'll find Tajik translators and informants picking out Pashtun villages, which are then hit by missiles and airstrikes. And we've alienated a good part of the population there. And it's this occupation, and this is the way Afghans look at it, cannot go on forever. It's just going to get more and more violent. And McChrystal, the commander, has asked for more troops. It's going to make no difference at all. I think it'll just make it worse. I've never seen the Afghans swallow something like this.
I want to turn to Rachel for one last question for you, Rachel. The role of women has been touted for many years in Afghanistan as being one reason why the U.S. occupation has gone in to fight the Taliban and al-Qaeda. Women have apparently been registered in large numbers in the south, but it's not clear that they actually did go out to vote. And you mentioned some women in Kabul being able to vote. How seriously do you think the women's vote will be taken? And are women essentially once more sort of a tool to justify the end result that some say have already been decided?
Well, we've got great concerns about the extent to which women were able to participate in these elections. I mean, I'm not underestimating how difficult it is, you know, the challenges of women's participation, particularly in conservative areas in the south and east. We see women in public life routinely threatened, intimidated. We've seen assassinations of significant figures of women in public life over the last few years, including an assassination of a councillor just a few months ago that scared a lot of women out of standing as candidates. But despite those challenges, we've known about these challenges for a long time, so it seems to me a great failing that so little was done to help women participate, and it all came so late in the day. For instance, the UN body tasked with helping the elections didn't get a gender advisor on board until June, just 2 months before the elections. And the whole problem of getting women to do security checks in women's polling stations wasn't talked about until the middle of July, just a month before the elections, when suddenly they turned around and thought, we have to recruit 1,400 security checkers, which, not surprisingly, didn't happen. And I could go on and on with examples like this. It was all too little too late, and consequently, we will have seen a very low turnout. And when we don't see a low turnout, often it's in these very conservative areas where we saw, you know, 55% women registering in kinds of provinces where women barely leave their houses. So it becomes a vehicle not just to disenfranchise women, but a huge vehicle for fraud, potentially. So I think the international community, the UN, and the government have got a lot to answer for in terms of their failings of thinking about women's security and making sure women can feel safe enough to participate.
Rachel, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Rachel Reed is Human Rights Watch representative in Kabul. Finally, Robert Baer, I want to play an excerpt of Rethink Afghanistan's latest installment on the issue of security and then get your comment. Here is an excerpt that features people like Juan Cole and Ahmed Rashid, as well as my guest, Bob Baer.
Our primary objective, as has been articulated by President Obama, is to defeat al-Qaeda. In fact, al-Qaeda does really not have a very substantial presence within Afghanistan.
Al-Qaeda is no longer in Afghanistan. They are not in Kandahar. They are not out in the desert. They are not in any part of Afghanistan. They've moved, but we are still fighting a war that the enemy's not even there. It's crazy.
Not so very long ago, General David Petraeus admitted that what I'm saying, which is that there's not much of a al-Qaeda presence in Afghanistan, if any at all.
No al-Qaeda at all in Afghanistan. Is that an exaggeration, General Petraeus, or is that true?
No, I would agree with that assessment.
We are fighting a war for empty buildings that al-Qaeda used to occupy. And what we're saying is now we own the hotel and you're not coming back in. It's a silly notion.
That's an excerpt from the latest installment of... Well, sorry about that little technical problem. That is the latest installment of the Rethink Afghanistan series produced by Brave New Films, and it features the issue of security. Robert Baer, former CIA operator and author of several books, including The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower. You were featured in that clip. So if there's no al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, what are we doing there?
We are trying to reconstitute Afghanistan in our vision. I don't think that anybody in this country or the administration understands Afghanistan well enough to do that, nor is there a public commitment to spend the years and years that it would take. I think this conflict is he's got about a year or two to go before the American people just turn against it, and seeing the obvious that we're not doing anything there.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us again. We hope to have you back on.
Thank you.
Robert Baer is former CIA operator, and he's written several books, and he's also featured in Rethink Afghanistan's latest installment, which you can find online at rethinkafghanistan.com. We'll link to it from our website later today as well at kpfk.org/uprising. This is Uprising. Near the end of our program today, we will speak with filmmaker Robert Stone about his brand new documentary called Earth Days. We'll also hear today's subversive historian, and after this short break, a new Amnesty report details violence in post-coup Honduras. Stay tuned.
Oh, now look who's got a moral compass.
I don't want to have to end up being forced to broadcast 9/11 stuff that I
don't
believe in.
Don't talk unless you know what you're talking about.
How does a man confess to a lie?
They're acting like the bourgeoisie always acts when they know they are doomed.
Over indoctrination.
Wow. There's some serious ethical implications.
What I can do, possibly, is to clear up a few misapprehensions that seem to have crept into the public discussion of this movement.
I'm Ian Johnston, and I need your top vote.
I think the world has been run long enough by the well-meaning professional.
Don't forget your history.
This is Gabriel San Roman, your subversive historian. Back in the day on August 20th, 1965, civil rights activist and seminarian Jonathan Myrick Daniels was gunned down in Alabama. The 26-year-old student heeded the call of Dr. Martin Luther King to stand in direct solidarity with the oppressed black people of Selma. Daniels took a leave of absence from his studies to march on the state capital of Montgomery alongside the civil rights movement. Another demonstration followed in Fort Deposit, Alabama, where he and 22 others were arrested. Upon release from jail days later, Daniels, a Catholic priest, and two young black students walked to a store in Hainville to get a soda. They were approached by Tom Coleman, a volunteer deputy sheriff, who pointed his gun at the teenage black girl when Daniels pulled her away and stepped in the line of fire, dying instantly. Coleman also seriously wounded the priest in a second shotgun blast, but an all-white jury acquitted the killer of his crimes. For Uprising, this is your truth professor saying it's no mystery why they conceal our people's history.
No more lies. No more lies. This is local station board candidate Joe Matthews. As a volunteer, I worked to feed the hungry on Skid Row. I worked as a volunteer by answering telephone calls during pledge drives at this radio station. As a member and part of the local station board, I would urge staff to aid the underdog in being masters of their own fate and leaders of their own souls. Corporations must be shunned as rulers of the people's destiny. Come, listeners, vote for me. This has been Joe Matthews at KPFK. Thank you.
This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. Honduran coup leader Roberto Micheletti on Tuesday ordered Argentine diplomats to leave the country within 3 days, citing that Argentine support for ousted President Manuel Zelaya constitutes unacceptable interference in Honduran internal affairs. Micheletti recently gave the same order to Venezuelan envoys who have stayed, refusing to accept orders from a leader they consider illegitimate. Argentine envoys don't plan to leave either. Foreign Relations Secretary Jorge Tayana stated, "We maintain diplomatic relations with the legitimate government of Honduras." Meanwhile, Amnesty International has released a full report on the current human rights climate in Honduras. The report includes photos and testimonies of many of the hundreds of people detained by police for participating in a peaceful march on July 30th in the capital, Tegucigalpa. Amnesty International expressed concern about the use of what they called excessive force, mass arbitrary detentions, harassment and intimidation of human rights defenders, limits imposed on freedom of expression and the number of attacks against journalists, closure of media outlets, confiscation of media equipment, and the physical abuse of journalists and camera persons covering events. A link to the full report is available at our website, kpfk.org/uprising, later today. Meanwhile, President Obama has suspended military aid to Honduras and revoked some interim leaders' visas, but some demand stronger U.S. action. Zahir John Muhammad is the Advocacy Director for International Affairs at Amnesty International. He now joins us to discuss that report. Welcome to Uprising, Zahir.
Thank you so much for having me.
So first, let's talk about what happened on July 30th. A peaceful march protesting the coup was the initial sort of report. But what happened at that peaceful march?
Sure, absolutely. Well, Amnesty was able to enter. We had a team of researchers enter into Honduras around July 30th. And what they reported was they had a chance to interview 75 people who were detained as a result of peacefully protesting at that event, 10 of whom were students, and we reported was a pattern that we were seeing in Honduras since the coup, which is excessive force. Individuals reported that they were beaten on their backs, on their buttocks. Women reported that they were being sexually assaulted as well, too. Excessive force was used. Some people beaten severely to the point needing hospitalization. People's cameras being destroyed. People being taunting, saying, if you come out to the street again, you're going to get more of this. Tell others that anyone who's supporting Zelaya will get more of the same.
And who is making these threats? Is it the police force? Are we talking about individuals or people directly connected with the post-coup government?
Well, what's really alarming is that these are uniformed police officers. That's one. And then behind the police officers are actually military personnel, which is just alarming that you have the military being involved in, basically civilian matters right now. And so basically egging them on from the back on were military officers. And that really sort of raises the question that what we're seeing in Honduras is that repression has become a policy of the current government in Honduras. And that's really alarming, the idea that officers can basically have carte blanche to use whatever force they need to suppress the protesters. And the fact that they're being taunted and saying, if you come out again, we're going to do this again, it raises the question of impunity, the idea that they are allowed to do basically whatever they want to deal with the supporters of Zelaya.
Now, is it mostly at demonstrations that the force is showed, or is it sort of in day-to-day life?
No, it's not just the individuals at the events. I mean, obviously there's an escalation at these particular peaceful protests, but we also have, and the report talks about curfew. I mean, sometimes we reported one incident of a curfew where the curfew was announced at 6:10 p.m., saying you have till 6:30 to enforce the curfew, 20 minutes. And, Honduras is a developing country. There is not the access of technology that we have in the United States. It's still a very poor country. You've got 20 minutes to enforce a curfew. People who are out on the streets unknowingly that there's a curfew would be rounded up. They'd be beaten. I mean, there's a complete climate of fear, and that's really what the report underscores, is that we all knew that there were abuses going on since the coup, but we really wanted to underscore that, one, this is policy, and two, that this is increasing.
So how did the information and the data get researched? Was it basically an Amnesty International delegation that went out and interviewed people and had eyewitness testimonies?
Yeah, absolutely. We basically took the first opportunity we got to enter Honduras. We sent a team of researchers from our London office into Honduras. They were only able to interview people at detention centers in the capital, and they interviewed 75 people, and 10 of whom were students. And part of the reason why we interview so many people is we want to sort of establish a pattern. We want to sort of show that, let's say one person talked about getting beaten on the back, or one woman spoke about being, sexually assaulted. We wanted to show that there are others who could corroborate this evidence as well too. And we did find that. We did find that excessive force was being used, and particularly women are vulnerable right now. I mean, some of the women were taunted, saying, "Why aren't you at home having sex with your husband?" Their blouses were ripped. Their buttocks were were abused by the military officials. It's quite egregious, the violations right now.
What about inside the detention as well, inside the prisons where some of the people who are being detained were taken? Do you know of abuse taking place inside prisons, and also how many still remain?
It's hard to say how many still remain. We estimate that there are hundreds that still remain, but I think our concern is really not about the number, but it's really about the pattern, that this has become a matter of policy in Honduras. Now, in terms of abuses within detention facilities, we're concerned that there might be, just given past records of abuse within detention facilities in Honduras. It's hard for us to verify that, though, because we interviewed people literally hours after they were detained, and many of them said, "Look, I was, I'm a 19-year-old student. I just was standing on the periphery of this event, just listening in, and they beat me and they threw me in this detention facility. Why am I here?" We had people as old as 59 years old talk about being detained and really having very little involvement in actually organizing the event. But it showed that the police officers were making very little distinction about, you know, the organizers. Really, anybody remotely in the site of these protests were rounded up.
I'm speaking with Zahir John Mohammed, Advocacy Director for International Affairs at Amnesty International. Amnesty just released a report yesterday highlighting the abuse of protesters in Honduras after the June 28th coup. What about journalists and people working in the media, both domestic and possibly foreign journalists? What sort of abuses have you recorded against them?
Yeah, sure. Well, unfortunately, journalists have had very little ability to operate within Honduras, and that was actually one of, and also human rights activists and human rights defenders as well too, and that was one of our concerns. We have a report about Roberto Barra, who's a Chilean independent photojournalist, and he said he was covering the peaceful demonstration on the 30th of July. He was taking photos, and someone shouted to him, you know, get the cameras off of him, and 20 police officers surrounded him, demanded that he hand over the camera. He refused to do so, and then they beat him and, you know, grabbed the camera from him. And he was told, you journalists are responsible for the situation, for the bad image abroad. Expletive, expletive. You're a communist just like the rest of them. And there are many other journalists as well, too, both from Latin America and from other countries, as well as you know, Honduran journalists that reported that they were not able to operate freely. I mean, media outlets such as Radio Globo have been closed down by the military and the de facto authorities. They've been taken off the air. We ourselves were concerned about our own security. And you have people being harassed and saying that they're afraid to come on air. So there really is a pervasive climate of fear right now in Honduras.
Also, talk about the issue of surveillance. I understand through your report that there's been an increase in surveillance of human rights organizations, particularly those that had been communicating with Amnesty.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of our paramount concerns is that, you know, when information sort of trickles out, they're contacting us. But many of them reported that they were afraid to speak with us. Their phones are being monitored. We have right here, there is an organization called the Center for Investigation and Promotion of Human Rights. They were detained for several hours by the police, the head of the organization, on August 12th, saying, you know, who are you talking to? What are you reporting out? Arriving at their offices, demanding to see their materials. So there's this idea that the government is really trying to control the information that is leaving the country, but they've been very unsuccessful, and we're very thankful for people who really sacrificed so much in trying to talk to us and get the message out. And what they really said to us is, look, we know the world is talking about how, you know, the Micheletti's government is fraudulent, etc., but what we really want to talk about is how, on a day-to-day basis, things are getting increasingly worse, and we want the international community to highlight these abuses.
Hmm. Now, how widespread have the protests been, both in the sort of early days after the coup and now? Meaning, are the tactics of the post-coup government becoming successful in keeping people afraid and off the streets?
Well, first of all, the amount of people on the street continues to increase because I think there's increasing frustration.
So they're actually increasing on the streets.
Yeah, absolutely, because I think, first of all, it's compounded by the fact that they're outraged over the coup itself. And second, they're outraged over how the de facto government has dealt with the supporters of Zelaya. And so they're now on the streets and they're saying, okay, we're first upset about the coup, and second, we're upset about how people are just being rounded up and beaten arbitrarily. Now, part of the reason why we released the report as well is that, you know, people are saying, look, you know, only two people have been killed. And I actually saw one interview saying, you know, that many people are oftentimes killed at a soccer match in Honduras. But really, the issue that we're drawing attention to is how widespread this is and how this is in so many different sectors of Honduras, so many different parts of the capital being affected, age ranges, people involved, you know, directly or indirectly with these events been rounded up, and then people just walking on the street because they happen to be 5 minutes past curfew that they didn't know about being rounded up, and they were saying, look, we need something to be done because we're really living in a complete total military state where we have no rights whatsoever.
Speaking of military state, how often are the curfews being invoked?
Well, that's the thing. The curfews are so limits are arbitrary. I mean, we were trying to ascertain that ourselves. Sometimes they might impose it at 6 p.m., sometimes it might be at 10 p.m., which really draws the question that these curfews are really not a way. It's not like, for example, you know, let's say every night at 9 p.m. everybody has to abide by a curfew because they don't want people out at night. It's really when the government hears about a particular event, they'll say, well, you know what, we actually have curfew. And then when they round people up, they say, you're violating the curfew. And they say, well, what curfew? How did you find out? You know, it's not like when the TV stations and the radio stations are being controlled now or being intimidated by the government, how are people able to find out really what's happening? And that's why they've been looking to international outlets, to find out exactly what's happening in Honduras.
Zahir, finally, what do you hope for your report to achieve? Who are you aiming it at most of all?
Well, our report is directed at the international community, again, because there has been outrage over the coup itself and the need to have some sort of talks with Zelaya about coming up with a solution. But really, Amnesty's focus is twofold. First, to underscore that the abuses are continuing and that when the international community condemns what happens in Honduras, they condemn not only the assault on democracy, which was the coup and the assault on people's rights, but also the international community condemns particularly the rising human rights abuses, the climate of impunity, and the de facto government's complete unwillingness to acknowledge, let alone investigate these attacks. That's one. Second is we're pushing for stronger reaction from the U.S. government. Now, I know that the Obama administration has spoken about this, but we think that the escalation of violence merits a stronger response from the Obama administration. The Obama administration needs to say, yes, talks have to continue with Zelaya, but at the same time, there also has to be a complete cessation of excessive force by the de facto government. That really hasn't been there, and I think the U.S. needs to take a stronger position, especially given the fact that the U.S. track record has not always been the best. This is an opportunity for the U.S. to sort of stand up and say, we're standing for human rights, we're standing up for democratic rights.
Zahir, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure.
Zahir Jan Mohammed is the Advocacy Director for International Affairs at Amnesty International, and we've been discussing the new report on post-coup violence in Honduras. And you can find out more about the report at Amnesty's website, amnestyusa.org. We'll also link to it from our website later today at kpfk.org/uprising. This is Uprising, and after this short break, we'll hear about a new film called Earth Days that's opening in theaters tomorrow. Stay tuned.
This is John Parker, and I'm running for the local station board. The mission at KPFK? Build the movement. And during this unprecedented economic crisis, we cannot allow the news to be cut and then sometimes spun like NPR. While the metaphysical programs of the station increase over those meant to help organize and unite us, we must reverse this trend, and my entry onto the board is a step in that direction. This is John Parker. I'd appreciate your vote for local station board.
This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. A new documentary by Robert Stone traces the history of the modern environmental movement through the lives of 9 pioneering Americans. Titled Earth Days, the film reaches as far back as the post-war America of the 1950s, the 1962 publication of Rachel Carson's seminal book Silent Spring, and the first ever Earth Day, marked in 1970. With vintage footage and stunning visual panoramas, Earth Days follows the vision and the fate of people like one-time Secretary of the Interior Stuart Udall, futurist Stuart Brand, former Congressman Pete McCloskey, nonprofit leader Hunter Lovins, and others. It highlights the successes, but also the failures of the movement. The New York Times reviewed Earth Days, calling it a, quote, beautifully composed tribute to visionary thinking and political ingenuity, a timeline of peaks and valleys stretching from the early initiatives of the 50s to the legislative successes of the 70s. Robert Stone wrote, produced, and directed Earth Days. His earlier film credits include Oswald's Ghost and Gorilla, The Taking of Patty Hearst. He joins me in studio. Welcome to Uprising.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks very much for joining us. Now, you start your film Earth Days by showing a series of clips of various presidents, American presidents over the years, one after the other declaring the importance of protecting the Earth, including Bush Sr. and Bush Jr. Why did you choose to open your film in that way?
Well, I wanted to start the film in a sort of unusual way, not just to set up what the film is going to be about, but to give a sense that we've been talking about the environment for a long, long time now. And I think the environment is fodder for soaring political rhetoric. But as the film points out, it's been a long time. We've known about this for a long time. We've known our problems for a long time. Yet here we are in 2009 at this moment of environmental crisis. So the film is really about how we got here.
I was quite surprised by the role of Nixon, who seemed to try very hard to jump on the environmental bandwagon. What was sort of Nixon's relationship to the then budding environmental movement?
Yeah, well, I'll start by saying I never imagined in my life I would make a film that actually presents a sort of favorable a favorable portrait of Nixon.
Well, partially favorable.
It is partially favorable. Look, Nixon was a very clever politician. He was responding to a massive grassroots uprising. Appropriate, we're on the show Uprising this morning. It really was. I mean, 20 million Americans took to the streets on Earth Day 1970. It was the largest demonstration in American history. 10% of the U.S. population. Be the equivalent of, in a single day, 40 million Americans going out in the street and demanding change. That was a political earthquake in this country. It totally changed the dynamics of how environmental issues were treated by the government. And Nixon was no friend to the environment, but he saw it to his political advantage to cater to this upswell of interest, you know, from the grassroots. And he was also looking forward to the next presidential election, where he saw he was going to go up against Edmund Muskie, who was a leader of the environmental movement. So he wanted to defuse that. But, you know, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what motivated him. The fact of the matter is, he signed into law the most sweeping series of pro-environmental legislation of any president ever.
Earth Days, by the way, is opening tomorrow at theaters across Southern California, including the Sunset 5 in West Hollywood, the Pasadena Playhouse 7, Lumley Monica 4 in Santa Monica, Encino Town Center, as well as in Irvine, Laguna Niguel, and Palm Springs. And we'll list that entire set of screenings on our website later at kpfk.org/uprising. Well, speaking of the very first Earth Day, I want to play an excerpt of your film Earth Days that starts by showing out the media coverage even at that time of the very first Earth Day. In retrospect, a little amusing, but also, as you said, 20 million people across the entire country came out in various parts of the country. Let's take a listen to Earth Days.
Some quarters saw more than coincidence in the fact that Earth Day occurred on the 100th anniversary of the birth of Lenin, the father of Soviet communism. The Comptroller General of Georgia, James Bentley, sent out $1,600 worth of telegrams warning that Earth Day might be a communist plot.
There were certainly people who had their pet causes. Some pounded vehicles apart with sledgehammers as a protest against the internal combustion engine. Others wore gas masks to protest air pollution. But also there was an almost celebratory thing, as though suddenly we were awakening to a new set of opportunities.
They are talking about emission control devices on automobiles, while we are talking about bans on automobiles. We are challenging the ethics of a society that, with only 6% of the world's population, accounts for more than half of its utilization of resources. Our country is stealing from the poorer countries of the world and from generations as yet unborn.
To me, Earth Day was life-changing. There were, around the country, millions of people engaging in some act of caring for the earth. I realized that there was a massive group of people who cared very deeply about the earth, and if organized, could be a viable political movement. At that point, I ceased to be an anti-war activist and became an environmentalist.
An excerpt of the film Earth Days. The woman's voice we just heard is Hunter Lovins. She's one of nine people who are profiled in the film as a look into the past, both successes as well as eventually a few failures of the environmental movement. The film written, produced, and directed by Robert Stone, my guest in studio. Robert, this this excerpt from the film shows an interesting snapshot of the history of the movement. And I want to ask you how the many of the people that you profiled in the film started out as sort of being radical, anti-establishment, wanting to ban cars, not just control emissions. Mm-hmm. But then some of them ended up being part of the establishment to help pass some of the most important environmental laws of our time. How did that happen? And was that, in retrospect, a good thing or a bad thing?
That's a great question. What happened with in the wake of Earth Day, when this sweeping legislation came through, a lot of the people in the environmental movement who were leaders in the environmental movement did move into positions of power, and these small organizations that had been out ahead of the whole movement became sort of large lobbying organizations in Washington. They became huge. The Sierra Club, which was a marginal organization before this, became a huge organization in Washington, and a number of other groups. I think one of the dangers, one of the bad things that happened, is the movement moved from being a grassroots popular movement to one that was being led by environmental activists, certain members of the political class, and scientists. And I think a lot of people thought, moving into the late 70s, that, okay, we have the EPA, we have all these laws on the books. If I can sign my check to the Sierra Club once in a while, people just sort of outsourced their activism in a sense. And it became kind of a battle between powerful lobbying groups in Washington, corporate industrial lobbying groups versus environmental lobbying groups. And the corporate industrial lobbying groups were always able to outspend the environmental lobbying groups, and a backlash ensued against the environmental movement, and Ronald Reagan kind of personified that in coming to power in 1980, really sort of ended that first burst of environmental activism.
I want to talk about Reagan, but I want to step back a little bit in time as well, in terms of what led up to that first Earth Day. You chronicle in your film the whole Earth movement, the Back to the Land movement, mm-hmm. the communes of the 60s, which were sort of laying the seeds for the environmental movement. And one of the people you feature in your film sort of looks back at the naivety of that movement. There's still people who mm-hmm. Who you might sort of put in that same category. Was it mostly sort of a liberal utopians, or were they really naive, or were they really wise?
Well, I think a little bit of both. I mean, look, if you want to change society on a large systemic level to make our whole presence on the earth as human beings more in tune and in sync with the ecosystem, rejecting society and going off into a little commune is not really going to do it. We need large systemic changes. So it was naive, but that said, it was I think one of the many forces that came together in this remarkable moment in time was this questioning of some of the real fundamental underpinnings of values of our society. Now, maybe it was a naive and like a little extreme, but it was part of the mix that came together at that moment.
Do you think it was sort of part of a necessary evolution, a sort of stage that people had to go through?
I think so, yeah. I think it was.
Let's go back even earlier to Rachel Carson's book in 1960. Her voice very much preserved in the Pacifica Radio Archives. She's somebody that Pacifica listeners are quite familiar with. Maybe some young environmentalists today have never even heard of Silent Spring, her book that really about pesticides that really many point to as the first major environmental book. What role did she play, not just in sort of waking up Americans to the dangers that are facing the earth, but even members of Congress and the government?
Rachel Carson is a pivotal person in the environmental movement, because before that you had the conservation movement, which was largely preserving wilderness areas. What Rachel Carson did was say that we as a species, through our technology and our presence on this planet, are actually harming the ecosystem that we need to live on. We're actually poisoning the planet itself. And that sort of broadened the whole idea of what environmentalism is. She was vilified by the chemical industry at the time. They launched a huge PR campaign, really saying that on a personal attack against her, saying she was a hysterical woman. She didn't know what she was talking about. And Stuart Udall, who's featured in the film, who was Kennedy's Secretary of the Interior at the time, gave Kennedy a copy of the book. Kennedy read the book, was very moved by it, came out and supported Rachel Carson, and set up a panel of scientists to examine her studies, examine her work, which confirmed that it actually was true. And that, you know, after that happened, it became a huge international bestseller and a huge influence on the public, and ended up leading to the ban on DDT and a number of other things later on.
One of the, to me, most horrifying moments in your film is the footage that you show when talking about Rachel Carson's book. This footage of giggling children in the 50s and 60s being sprayed with pesticide while eating their school lunches,
sure,
while
yeah.
swimming in a pool.
Yeah. Well, DDT was sprayed all over this country, and indeed all over the world. And one of the things that was discovered in the early 1960s that Rachel Carson pointed out was that every living thing on the planet, every living organism had DDT in its fat cells now. That's how widespread this had become.
And that leads me to asking you about the visual aspect of the film Earth Days. You found some incredible footage, some very high-quality footage. What was that? Why was that important? And how did you go about collecting the vintage footage from the 50s, 60s, 70s to put into this film?
Well, it was a huge job, and I'm glad you recognize that. It was, I mean, first and foremost, I'm making a film. It had to be cinematic. It had to engage people on a visual and emotional level. So
it's not just talking heads.
It's not talking heads. No, it's a story that's focused around these nine individuals, but it's not talking heads. It's a very visual film, and very colorful. We started off, it was going in another direction. We started off looking at a lot of news footage from that talked about the literal history of what was being said, and the story. That ended up not being an avenue that was really satisfying to me, and we ended up broadening it out and using more contemporary visuals as well as historical footage. So it's a real mixture of using imagery that's more poetic, that's kind of, if you see the image and then you hear what's being said and the music and all, it's come together. The visuals are not necessarily a literal representation of what's being talked about, but they allow your mind to start to expand and to think about things in a different way. And that's really what happened in this period of awakening to the crisis, was largely a new perception of the world around us, a new perception of reality that was, you know, articulated best by those amazing photographs of the Earth from space, which we began to see in 1969.
Let's talk about Reagan. There were, of course, and are still so many successes that one can point to of the environmental movements starting in the 70s. But then came Reagan. And even though he did talk like every other president about the importance of protecting the environment, he undid so much of what was done.
He actually didn't say that much. The one clip we have is the only clip, mentioned.
Okay.
But no, I mean, you can't blame it entirely on Reagan. Reagan was articulating a movement. What was amazing, we found this incredible footage that I'd never seen before of Reagan when he announced his candidacy for the presidency in 1979. It was like a 20-minute infomercial produced by the Republican Party. And in it, he basically lays out the reason that he wants to become president is to undo the environmental movement. And that was a major reason for him seeking the presidency. And he's quite articulate in saying that his perception of the environmental movement, I think the perception of a lot of Americans at that time, that it was putting constraints on the American dream, and nothing should limit our ability to do whatever we want to do. And he sort of wanted to go back to the 1950s and just say everything's fine. We don't. And, you know, he ultimately dismantled the solar panels on the roof of the White House that Jimmy Carter put up.
Finally,
symbolic gesture. Yeah.
Robert Stone, what is the importance, you think, of knowing the history of the environmental movement?
Well, I think, you know, I think like anything else, those who don't know their history are condemned to repeat it. The environmental movement has been a very forward-looking enterprise. It's just the nature of it. But I think knowing this, most people now are getting bombarded with one crisis after another, lots of information about the environment. What I attempt to do in this film is to put all of this, to step back a bit, put all of this in some sort of larger context about how we arrived at this moment where we are now. There's no way we can find our way forward without knowing how we got here.
And you can certainly find that out in Earth Days, the new film we're talking about. Writer, producer, and director Robert Stone has been joining me in studio. Thanks so much for joining us. Best of luck to you and the film.
Thanks very much.
Earth Days can be found online at earthdaysmovie.com, and it's opening tomorrow in theaters across Southern California, including the Sunset 5 in West Hollywood, Pasadena Playhouse 7, Lemley Monica 4. And you can also check our website later today for a full listing at uprising, kpfk.org/uprising. For Sonali, subversive thought for the day, Wendell Berry once said, "The care of the earth is our most ancient and most worthy, and after all, our most pleasing responsibility. To cherish what remains of it and to foster its renewal is our only hope." That's Wendell Berry. That's an Ali subversive thought for the day. You've been listening to Uprising. To get a CD of today's program, contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or online at pacificaradioarchives.org. Gabriel San Roman is our assistant producer. Natalie Yar is our intern. Jose Juan Bustamante is our engineer. You can hear an audio stream of the show after 10 a.m. at our website, kpfk.org/uprising. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening. See you tomorrow at 8.